This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, everybody.
And tonight we are also joined by our special guest host from Tranco Dreams and Game Warp. It gives me great pleasure to welcome my good friend, Miss Kim Lowe.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going well, Kim. Obviously, tonight we are talking about Stephen Chow's Got a Cookery. Surprisingly, it's taken us this long to really talk about Stephen Chow, a Hong Kong director slash actor slash producer slash wearer of many hats, who basically burst onto the Western scene with the likes of Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle, only to really disappear as quickly as he had appeared. Yet, in his homeland, he has continued to make films. And tonight, we're obviously going to be looking at one of his earlier films from 1996 with The God of Cookery. But before we obviously get into that, I mean, we've obviously just had the festive break. I mean, how did your viewing go over the festive break? I mean, did you manage to watch anything at all, Stephen? Or was it just a case of, like myself, where you had all these great plans and nothing came of it?
Oh, that's the story of my life, mate. But I have started something. So I have started recording every film I watch, Asian or whatever, on my Twitter feed. So now when you ask me what I've watched, my plan for the year is I'm going to write everything down and see how many films I watch, whether I watch them at the cinema or at home or whatever. So I've watched a couple of things in Asian cinema land, sort of been catching up on some of the DVDs I've had hanging around. So I caught Yoshiharu Hasebe's Massacre Gun, which was something Arrow put out a few years ago, sort of a noir, yakuza, gangster film in the vein of Branded to Kill, I suppose, but not quite okay. As crazy.
Yeah.
Same lead actor. It's a fine, well-made, jazzy gangster flick. If you're into that kind of thing, I would say fairly unexceptional. And what was the other one? And then I know you don't like me talking about this, but I've started going through my Female Prisoner Scorpion Blu-ray collection. So I rewatched Jailhouse 41, and it'd been a long time since I'd seen it, and I'd forgotten how artsy and weird and surreal, with little forays into kabuki cinema and frankly Japanese pornography tropes, as well as being really rather entertaining. So I had a sort of the average to the excellent, I think you would put it down as.
Yeah, I mean, the Female Prisoner Scorpion series, they aren't your traditional women in prison movies, at least. They do go off in some interesting directions. Obviously, they do feature our favourite leading lady, Miko, who is just always wonderful. I don't know whether I'm watching Stray Cat Rock or Female Prisoner Scorpion or Lady Snowball. She's just always wonderful.
And it's even better than this one. She says two words, and that's it. Everything else is just her glaring and acting with her eyes. And, you know, as we've said before, in Asian cinema, an actor or actress that acts with their eyes is actually quite rare. So, yeah, very, very emotive, very, it's just wonderful.
Obviously, Kim, I mean, you yourself, I mean, you're, again, someone who wears many hats. If we just look at your blog, Tranquil Dreams, I mean, you're doing baking, you're doing films, you're doing books. I mean, it's many things that you cover through your site. I mean, how was your sort of festive viewing? Did you manage to get much watched, or was it just sort of like being distracted by families and then wanting to be entertained and whatnot?
Well, I did a lot of watching, just not a lot of Asian cinema, which is something that I've missed and I've talked about in my 2018 plans to kind of like bring that into my blog now, is I'm going to start having more focus on Hong Kong cinema, which is where my roots really are. So yeah, I mean, I watched a lot of 2017 movies, you know, like 47 Meters Down and Arrival and that sort of stuff, you know. Kong Skull Island.
Yeah, I watched Kong Skull Island as well. It's Kong Skull Island fills me with great hope for the inevitable Godzilla versus Kong that is going to be coming up. I believe it's 2019. They're currently penciling it in for at the moment. And I mean, I don't know, growing the term, I mean, what we obviously fought on the American one as of late. I personally liked it, although it had too much of a human story and not enough of a, you know, kaiju story for a Godzilla movie. And certainly Kong Skull Island, I thought, was a great boy's own adventure. And it's just nice for them just to do just a straightforward Kong story without confusing it with, like, all the old tropes of, like, human sacrifices and the blonde maiden who has to be sacrificed by the obvious hostile tribe who live on Skull Island. So it was kind of nice for them to mix up some of the usual tropes there. I mean, Stephen, have you seen Kong Skull Island yet? Or?
Oh, yeah, I saw it a few months ago. I really enjoyed it. You know me, I like a trashy movie. I really didn't enjoy the remake, the latest remake of Godzilla. I found it well made but boring, and wasted the best character by killing him off in the first act. I'm looking at you, Bryan Cranston. And then the rest of the movie was just people shuffling back and forth for no purpose, and then it got quite interesting in the final act. But I thought Kong Skull Island is stupid. It's a stupid, stupid B-movie with kind of good special effects, and again, a bit of a wasted cast. I'm looking at you, Mr. Tom Hiddleston. But I just thought it was just a huge amount of fun and way better than I was expecting. And like you say, a little bit at the end, which has given us a hint of maybe a fun monster movie, kaiju based, to come.
Yeah. I mean, obviously with the legendary MonsterVerse, it's next going to be Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is going to introduce Mothra, King Ghidorah, and Rodan, which is going to be interesting to see. It's also going to be interesting to see if they screw up these monsters, seeing as they're so established. I'm really interested to see how they obviously play that out. I'm hoping, like Kong Skull Island, they're just doing a straightforward adventure romp and not trying to bog it down in humanity and human story and whatnot, because it just doesn't need it. And it also doesn't need to be around two to 3 hours long, which most movies seem to feel that they have to be now. So, I don't know, a nice short romp would be great. As for myself, I mean, I finally got the Letterboxd year in review back, and after 166 films logged of last year, it's given me a target to obviously aim to beat this year. Obviously, being Christmas and all, I did enter into it with oh so many great plans. I was going to watch The Villainess. I had like all these like films that I was going to watch. I had like Tales of Surprisingly Fast Swimmers, Valerian, Tusk, some Western cinema in there as well. And and Baby Driver as well, which everyone raved about, and I finally watched the other day, and I have to say it was pretty naff. So
you what? Right, I'm cancelling the podcast.
Okay,
that was my film of the year.
Really?
I adored it. It's like the best musical ever.
Yes, it's sort of like Edgar Wright. You can time stuff in, so you can time gunshots so they match up with the soundtrack. It's like, yes, that's a very clever trick. Now, how about we don't repeat it constantly? Jamie Foxx can just naff off for ruining that movie. He didn't need to be there. The soundtrack was good, but, I mean, I think the people who were impressed by it obviously had never heard these tracks, because if you're doing the Blues Explosion track, Bell Bottoms, you don't need hammy and sort of weird dancing along karaoke to it. Which we obviously got, and it sort of like killed any coolness of that track. And as soon as they hit like Radar Love, I was like, oh, for Christ, you're just going for any easy driving track you can now. So, but John Hamm was good. I just wish he'd had more chance to be a villain. But more importantly,
we'll have to agree to disagree on that, shall we?
We will. We're starting a new podcast called Elwood and Stephen Argue About Stuff.
It was about time.
While we're obviously on the front, though, of disagreeing about things, I did watch Sion Sono's Anti-Porno, which you mentioned on the previous show, and you mentioned not being a fan. I have to say that I'm very worried that I'm becoming a diehard Sion Sono fan, because I really, really enjoyed Anti-Porno. It's obviously, if you're not aware of it, it's Nikatsu, the studio. They are, at the moment, kickstarting their Roman Porno sub-label, or romantic porno, to give it its proper title. And Anti-Porno is one of the titles that is being included in this revamp, and it's basically the more like you're watching an art house movie, but it's absolutely filthy at the same time. And it's just so wonderfully weird, yet beautifully shot. And I think it was this weird combination of extreme styles that just really appealed to me. And the fact that, like any good Sion Sonic movie, like Why Don't You Play in Hell, it just managed to surprise me every sort of turn. It's just that I thought I had figured out something would happen and it would just completely throw me. So I think if we're totaling things up that we've disagreed about, and we're, what, one show into the new year, Stephen? That's two now, so...
So I found it. I just thought it was a missed opportunity. I thought it looked good. I thought performance was good. I just thought it was like a student movie, and I thought it was biting the hand that fed it, frankly. But anyway, well, that's two for two. Let's see how we go. Yeah.
Kim, I mean, are you a fan of Sion Sono at all, or
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just like in a daze listening to what you guys are talking about. I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. Okay. Absorb.
I wouldn't worry. I'm sure once we get on to Stephen, once we get into tonight's film and start talking about Stephen Chow, because of the horrible distribution of his films, and Stephen obviously having better connections than I do, is meant that a lot of these films I've not seen, which you two obviously have. So.
What I'm looking forward to, Elwood, tonight is that usually, Kim, this show is two white guys utterly fail to pronounce any names, especially Chinese names, well. So we're hoping that you're going to correct us and teach us.
Okay. Deal.
Yeah, so, I mean, when it comes to, obviously, come to Hong Kong Chinese cinema, the names are slightly easier. It's not like when we look at Japanese cinema or Korean cinema, where it just gets very confusing, especially Indonesian cinema, where they just seem to be putting letters anywhere they can. It is a little easier to pronounce some of these names, so hopefully we won't be butchering too many names on tonight's show. But obviously, Stephen Chow, I mean, he's, as we said, he's a man of many hats, like many leading men and actresses in Hong Kong cinema. I mean, what do we know really about Stephen Chow, Stephen?
Well, apart from he's got a really fantastic name and he spells it the correct way. Okay, so actually, you know, I've actually written quite a lot about Stephen Chow and seen a lot of his movies. So I'll just give our audience a little a potted history via his films. And Kim, please jump in if you think I'm wrong or you have something to add. So I guess if you think of the sort of the famous names that have sort of crossed over into the public consciousness of Hong Kong cinema, certainly modernish Hong Kong cinema, you think of Jackie Chan, you think of Jet Li, you think of Chow Yun-fat on the male side. And I'd say Stephen Chow Sing Chi is another, mostly because of the success of Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle over a decade ago now, but he is very much rooted in the realms of comedy. He famously got rejected as a young man as an actor at TVB, but managed to sort of cling on to a career by presenting a children's TV show. So you could think of what's the fella that did Shrek and all that, the Canadian actor that Mike also Myers. Starred in Mike Myers. So very similar to Mike Myers, basically got his break acting in children's breakfast TV. Two things that, apart from his films, I guess people will, or two things that we can sort of assign to him. One is, and this is where I'm going to fail, is that he's famous for what they call Mo Lei Tao cinema. It's kind of hard to explain. We could call it sort of nonsense slapstick, but it's full of, basically it's a sort of humor that fundamentally logically makes no sense. So there might be anachronism, slapstick, fast, especially in his cinema, making use of the coarseness of Cantonese, surreal moments. It breaks the fourth wall. It's not that he invented this style, and when we talk about further watching, I'll give you another actress that that you can follow up. So it's kind of fast paced, crazy, and also at times quite postmodern. It's sort of rooted in modernity. So there'll be things that we watch that we won't understand because we're not living in Hong Kong today. So that can be both fascinating and frustrating when watching as a Westerner. And the other thing is you may hear talk about the Sing Girls, which are a collection of actresses that have basically got their big break by starring in a Stephen Chow film. People like Cecilia Chung, Eva Huang, Kitty Zhang. And also quite often he seems to be romantically involved with them, but, you know, I'm not a gossip. But you'll also find in his films people like his co-star tonight, Karen Mok, Kingdom Yuen, and Charlotte Chung, who are stars in and of their own right. And you'll even, if you dig to the odd film here and there, you'll find some of the superstars, Maggie Chung Man-yuk, Gong Li, and Anita Mui, all appear in one or more of his movies. So, quick rundown, some of the films that I think are important. So he, like I say, initially got rejected for being too short by TVB, went on 4:30 Space Shuttle as a children's TV show, actually appeared in a number of films, and actually won an award for his sort of first role in a film called Final Justice in 1988, but it was a straight film. And it wasn't until 1990 where he starred in a film called All for the Winner, which is basically it's a parody of Chow Yun-fat's God of Gamblers. And not only did he come out as a star in his own right in that film, the famous Wong Jing, the producer director of the Roger Corman of Hong Kong, shall we say, picked up on him, got him to appear in the official God of Gamblers sequel, and then headline the third film in the trilogy. So yeah, in a weird thing that probably could only happen in Hong Kong cinema is that the star of the parody ended up starring in the main films themselves. He also his first time he paired with Ng Man Tat, who again was in tonight's film, who's probably in 80% of the films that he's famous for. So that was the first one. Then he went on to go into his sort of first set of films, so the Fight Back to School series, which pretty much like 21 Jump Street. He's a policeman who is sent back to fake it as a student to I think it's to deal with drug dealers or bullying or something like that. You get the idea. Very popular. First film's excellent, the other two aren't bad. His career carried on. He appeared in a couple of famous lunar comedies. Then there's a series of period set comedies, my favorite of which is Justice My Foot, but there's Flirting Scholar and a few others, which, you know, he takes the famous sort of historical figures and puts a sort of a modern comedic bent on it. His first direction, first film as a director, Love on Delivery, which is an absolute favourite of mine, but it's probably a bit too hardcore Hong Kong comedies for the uninitiated. But then we get the series of films which he suddenly goes up a notch. He starts making less films, but they're much better quality. So we'll start with the James Bond spoof from Beijing with Love, which I think is probably his most accessible movie to the Westerners, because we understand what he's riffing on. His utterly fantastic Journey to the West duology, The Chinese Odyssey Part 1, Pandora's Box, and Part 2, Cinderella, which are must-watches. We then go to tonight's film, The God of Cookery, which suddenly, although is riffing very much on the sort of films he was doing in the past, has a darkness to it, which I think we'll probably talk about. Certainly a dark moment, which is a stepping stone for him as an artist. And then he goes to The King of Comedy, which is also known as the one which not a lot of people think is very funny, but I actually think is absolutely fantastic. It's probably his most mature work. Then internationally, he broke out with Shaolin Soccer. He finally got hold of CGI and was able to realize some of his crazier ideas. And in the days before YouTube, people, honestly, that didn't know about Asian cinema was sending around as email attachments clips from Shaolin Soccer. So it was it really did sort of break him into an international audience. Then there's a film which I suspect is Elwood's favorite, Kung Fu Hustle, which is his sort of love letter to Shaw Brothers films and the like. I'm not a fan, actually, but everyone else seems to love it, so...
The list of things we disagree about is growing. We're one episode into the year, as we said.
I know. I personally find it's his character I dislike. I think his character succeeds through no... for no reason. He doesn't have a journey. So one of the things we will find, and I guess we might talk about tonight, he does have quite a common threaded story. So either he's a kind of naive to start, or he's a horrible arrogant person to start. He has a fall, and it's usually the story of his fall and then his rise up to after having usually some kind of Buddhist related realization and becomes a better person because of it. But I just don't think he had that in Kung Fu Hustle. And then probably that was the end. He made another film called CJ7 after that, based on that. And I love CJ7. CJ7 is a kid's film. It's got a cuddly little alien in it, and it's got J.C. Wu acting as a little boy. It is not what people were expecting. And then he kind of fell off the radar for about 10 years. He did co-direct another Journey to the West type film, which it made a lot of money, but isn't spectacular. Shaquille's in it.
How many Journey to the West movies do we need?
Well, there are a lot. How many Legends of the Condor TV shows do we need? I mean, it's a classic thing. However, 2 years ago now, he came back in style with The Mermaid, which at the time was the highest grossing Chinese film ever. It also marked the first time he'd worked in Mandarin, but he directed it. He didn't star in it, but it was my film of the year that in 2016. I thought it was a fantastic return to form. Has he followed up on it? Not quite yet, because guess what? He co-directed with Choi Hark another Journey to the West film, which wasn't very good, or not as paying as it ought to be. So basically, there you go. There's a solid body of work. I've covered 10, 11 films there, which I think are fairly essential. There are probably another 30 in various parts he's gone in. But the important thing is there is a common theme to his films. And I think God of Cookery, which is why I've chosen it tonight, I think it's not necessarily anyone's top three Stephen Chow films, but I think it embodies everything about his work in an easily accessible bite-sized morsel.
Cool. Kim, I mean, obviously your experience with Stephen Chow, I mean, was there a particular film which started this interest in his work, or was it just through the general sort of releases that you just stumbled across his work every time something new came out?
Actually, Stephen Chow is like me and my cousin's collective thing that we'd like to do. Stephen didn't mention it, but our favorite movie in our family is Tricky Brains. Yeah, so Tricky Brains is one that our family, we watch our cousins whenever we sit together. When we were kids, we would just watch it. We would just put it on and watch it. And it's such a great movie. It's like really fun, really entertaining. And, you know, there's that. And then there's like All's Well Ends Well. And one of my first theater experiences when I was in Hong Kong was inappropriately flirty scholar. Like that. Yeah. So like I went to go see that. I was like 8. I didn't understand anything that was going on. I only knew it was Stephen Chow and I liked the guy. So I was sitting there.
So Tricky Brains is one of his sort of Wong Jing era films, but again, it's a stargazer's classic. It's got, you got Andy Lau, you got Rosamund Kwan, Ching-Mei Yao, and Stephen Chow. So absolutely, it's but I feel that's probably one for the locals rather than the
those of us
looking in.
Yeah, that's definitely it. You know, you gave like you're like Mo Lei Tao is what you call the type of humor he has. And for us, I understand that. I actually explained it to my husband the first time we were going to sit down and watch a Stephen Chow movie. I called it absurd humor. It's something that I've coined for it because it's just so nonsensical. And it does get lost in translation a lot. There's a lot of puns that I get. And, you know, I think one of the classics that I always bring up is, you know, in God of Gamblers, there's this part where they talk about, like, aces, and then he pulls up, like, five cigarettes. And it's just because cigarettes and ace is said the same way in Chinese. So, like, Westerners watching this will be like, what the heck does that mean? You know, there's nothing funny about it. And then, like, I'd be the one cracking up, and my husband is, like, question marks all around his head. Like, what is she laughing at, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. The journey to the Pandora's Box and Cinderella movies are full of that as well, and it just flies over my head. And it was quite interesting. If I ever get to watch a Stephen Chow movie in a cinema, say in London, full of Chinese people, their laughter are belly laughs. because especially Cantonese. Cantonese is a complicated, filthy language.
Yes.
full of lots of homonyms and synonyms and things like that, and idioms. And I think he plays on that really well. But for a Westerner, it's more the visual that we're getting. You know, we're still able to understand that something's absurd or crazy, but what we don't get, and the frustration for me is that I don't understand Cantonese. So I know I'm missing 40% of what's going on.
Okay, I mean, would you say it's lost in translation style of humour that is the reason that he's not had more films brought over to Western audiences, and that we've sort of just been left with these two films, obviously Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle? I mean, The Mermaid, as I mentioned already, didn't get a release over here in the UK. I'm not sure if it got a release in the States, obviously, because probably have more chance of reaching its audience in the States than it would over here. I mean, can you sort of pinpoint any particular reason why we haven't seen more of his films sort of transferred over and translated for Western audiences?
Well, I think it's because, on the whole, he doesn't work in the realms of the genres of horror or of action or things like that, which sometimes can... You can handle the subtitles because lots of explosions or scares going on. I mean, his style, his humour. So again, tonight, the film we'll look at, it's absolutely embedded in Hong Kong. The locations it uses, the characters, as one note as they may be, are absolutely Hong Kong, and they don't necessarily translate well. And one of the things I always wonder is how he actually got so popular in mainland China. Because I'm certain a lot of those things which Kim was talking about, a lot of that language doesn't translate to Mandarin either. So unless it's about the character, the characters, it doesn't work. Though I mean the written characters, the actual vocal stuff. Because when I've been in Hong Kong, mainlanders don't understand it. They understand less than me because Mandarin is so different to Cantonese. I think it's just because it's just so embedded. So there's one thing having a John Woo movie or a Joy Hart movie, which involves martial arts and sort of dashing action. But I think humour is absolutely embedded in both the language and the culture of Hong Kong. So Shaolin Soccer worked because it's about football. That's the sport of the world. Even in America, they know what soccer is, right? But it just did that. And then I think Kung Fu Hustle probably came in on the coattails of that. But of course, Kung Fu movies from Bruce Lee onwards have an audience in the West as well. So those were the two which made it. And then he stopped. You know, he stopped making films. So I guess he's probably architect of his own downfall. Now, interestingly, well, I don't know about downfall. I think he's very rich and very happy, actually. But he did... there was talk of a Western remake of God of Cookery, got quite advanced, and he was going to come over and direct it. And Jim Carrey was up for the to play the main role, but it didn't happen. Now, actually, if we're wanting someone to sort of try and balance out that sort of Ace Ventura era, Jim Carrey might have been actually quite a good analog for Stephen Chow, but didn't happen, so we never know, and it's probably best that way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly at the moment, Stephen Chow just seems to be happy being a producer, and because everything I can see is sort of more Journey to the West. And I mentioned already, I mean, with Journey to the West, it is currently getting a Western remake. They're remaking Monkey, I believe, at the moment, or Journey to the West. I can't remember which title they've gone with, but I know they're featuring an all-American cast. There is no Asian actors in the cast, from what I can see. And, I mean, obviously, after question, I mean, is it offensive to do the story of Monkey without Asian actors? I mean, we've obviously had Monkey translated over here in the UK, and it had kind of, how can I say, racially unsensitive dubbing to it. But at the same time, it was still keeping all the dialogue there. It wasn't changing it and trying to dumb it down for Western audiences. I mean, Stephen Kim, I mean, would you say it's a sort of story that has to be told with Asian actors, or can it be produced with just Western actors?
Well, I think that, you know, I think asking me is a little bit hard because I feel like I'm biased a little, because Journey to the West is something that I grew up with. It's a very popular story that stems from a lot of Chinese legends and a lot of like really colorful characters, but still embeds a lot into, you know, some characters are very influenced by, like, say, Buddhism, or just that sort of just like goddesses and stuff like that. And, you know, it depends what angle they take and what type of story they want to tell. I think that really, I think that there is enough, you know, if you really dug, you would be able to find, you know, some American-born Chinese or something who could do this, who would probably be able to take the role on fairly well, you know, just off the top of my head, you know, the guy from Edge of 17, you know, he's a good actor. He could have done that, you know. So I just don't know the fascination. And, like, I think it really depends what angle they take. It's kind of like, you know, whenever you watch something and then it's supposed to be Asian and it's not, then you always feel a little bit empty watching it because it doesn't appeal as much.
Yeah. Stephen, I mean, do you have any strong thoughts on retelling the story of Monkey again? Or
I don't mind people retelling the stories of Monkey. I don't mind the wider Journey to the West. I don't mind anybody doing anything, really, as long as you do it well. I don't even mind doing a non-Asian version of it and embedding it in some other framework. Yeah, you can tell the same story in another framework. Asian films do it as well. They take Western stories and make Asian-bedded versions of them. I think what I have a problem with is if this film has all the trappings of an Asian film with a white or certainly a non-Asian cast, I'd find that quite bizarre. Yeah. And that would be a... So when we talked about Ghost in the Shell, I wasn't bothered that they had de-Asianified Ghost in the Shell because the story wasn't dependent on that. If this story is dependent on being in the Asian supercontinent and in Buddhism and all those other things, then it just feels a bit weird and a bit wrong.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're going to remake it, at least do something interesting with it, such as like we saw with the game in Slave Journey to the West, which was Andy Serkis basically gave it a futuristic take on it, which obviously had monkey battling robots as he made his way through like a post-apocalyptic New York. It's still really, really good, and it's still something that I would love to have seen him turn into some sort of feature film. But unfortunately, the game kind of flew under the radar and they never actually did anything else with it. But I think if you're going to do something with it, don't cast Western actors playing Asian roles. And second, just do something interesting with the material. That's all I ask. I suppose I've always got the water margin for them to leave alone and just leave in its perfect form. We're going to take a quick break, and no doubt me and Steven are going to find more things to argue about. But when we return, we are going to obviously be looking at tonight's selection, which is Stephen Chow's The God of Cookery.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, are still listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm, of course, your host, Edward Jones. And joining me still is, of course, Stephen.
Hello.
And our special guest host for this evening, Miss Kim Lowe.
Hey.
Tonight we are obviously talking about the 1996 Stephen Chow movie, The God of Cookery. I mean, Stephen, this is your pick. Why did you go with Stephen Chow for your pick this month?
Okay, well, obviously, I guess, as I said in the first half, I might be a bit of a Stephen Chow obsessive. But I think one of the things that I want, again, you know, in my writing is that I always want to show that there's more to Asian cinema than kung fu movies and long-haired ghost girls. And one of the things that I do find is a bit absent sometimes, again, as we talked about earlier, is about comedy. And because of the nature of comedy sometimes being stuck in culture and language. But I think, you know, Stephen Chow has proved that some of his stuff can cross the borders and cross the barriers. And I just think this is a key Stephen Chow movie, because it's when he suddenly became much more even though he's only a, let's not kid ourselves, he didn't direct this, he's down as the co-director. Clearly he just directed some of the comedy sequences, but there's a maturity about this one. So, for example, you know, it starts as the film people say in media res, and then we go back in time to find out how we got there. There's some clever stuff, there's some beautiful photography of food as well, so you'll get hungry watching this one. But it's got a fairly standard story, there's nothing too complex going on, and even if you don't get all the filthy jokes, you'll certainly get what's going on. It's fairly fast paced, and I think it's Chow in a nutshell in terms of the character arc that his character goes through.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is probably one of his more overlooked films when we obviously talk about the Stephen Chow back catalogue, and even more so because this was actually one of the few ones that actually did get that Western release. And for myself, it was a film I discovered through Jonathan Ross. He was doing a series of programs where he was looking at Japanese cinema, Korean cinema, and Hong Kong cinema, and he actually met with Stephen Chow in it, and he was saying about how he really liked God of Cookery, but though he didn't actually understand most of what was going on. And Stephen Chow didn't seem kind of a little dismissive of this one. So I'm not sure what his sort of particular feelings are on God of Cookery. But here he actually plays Stephen Chow, but I'm right in saying that it's a different spelling of the name. Is that right, Kim?
Yes.
And he's basically this celebrity chef who is sort of become the self-proclaimed God of Cookery. And in doing so, he's now really arrogant and cocky, and he's just a general ass to all his fellow chefs, who we see at the beginning he's just there dismissing and finding faults with all their dishes. And he basically gets usurped by another chef called Bull Tong, played by Vincent Cock. See, I'm pausing just because I know I'm pronouncing these wrong. I'm just waiting to be called out on it. So And he's basically sent back into the slums, and he has to find a way to retrain and battle his way up to reclaim his title as being the king of, sorry, the god of cookery. And insanity ensues, I think is the safe way to say, because this is a truly bonkers film, even as a Westerner watching it, and not perhaps not understanding all the humour. Just the actual visual elements of this film are just absolutely insane, and especially when we get into the finale, which I can't help but wonder if the makers of Ratatouille drew inspiration from this film, because they're startlingly similar.
I would have thought so. I mean, what we have here is a literal deus ex machina, don't we? And the gods literally appear and sort everything out. This is classical Greek theatre at its purest.
Kim, what's your sort of opening thoughts on God of Cookery?
I'm going to be really honest that God of Cookery actually took, I think, one or two, like at least a second or third watch for me to really appreciate it, which is something that I can't say for King of Comedy, because I don't like that one at all. God of Cookery is really fun. I think that's the word to say, like, to use, because it's just really out there. He meets these, like, odd characters and this odd triads, and they're not really triads because they're just fighting over, like, who sells what at the market. And it's just, you know, it really kind of like flips around what you expect will be next. And then like he plays his classic, you know, he kind of like really gets back into a lot of like his earlier roles and the type of humor he had then. And I don't know, I like it now. I like it quite a bit because there's just so many like nice characters that also support him, you know. Mantat Ng, and then there's like, Karen Mok was, great in this. And I don't know if this is one of the first roles he's done with Karen Mok.
She's in the Journey to the West pair, which he basically made around this. So she did quite a lot of films, but this was obviously a key time. I think they were quite friendly at the time.
Yeah, well, they still remain friends, right? I mean, in The Mermaid, she did the song, the main song for that, too. You can really see that the whole cast was having a ton of fun as they were doing this. And, you know, you see a lot of characters that really, like, appear in a lot of his movies. And I think that that's one of the fun things about Stephen Chow is that, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but in like the Hong Kong industry, he's not known as like a great person to work with. He's actually quite frustrating to work with. He doesn't have a good title in that sense. He's kind of an ass in all terms. And it's because of his demand for perfection that he's like that. And that's why he's so hard to work with. But you see that he's built friendships with a lot of actors that actually really like to be in films with him and really have a lot of fun just making different films together. And God of Cookery really kind of like puts that all together. And I really like, you know, as I watch this more, I start appreciating all these moments that, you know, is so unexpected, you know, like Nancy Sitt just breaks out in a dance in the middle of like the thing. And you're just like, what the heck is going on?
So maybe actually, so that's something that's something maybe you could help with, Kim, because I know who Nancy Sitt is, but I think, to a common garden Westerner, she's going to mean nothing, and having her prance around with the, you know, it's hilarious what she's doing. But I think to a lot of people, they won't get the actual madness of that scene because of who she is. Is that fair to say?
I would say that, yeah. I mean, but I think that like Hong Kong cinema is so much, and Nancy Sitt was really like key in a lot of like TVB series, which is like, you know, the main TV channel in Hong Kong that people don't know about. And they would have these like, they have like the leading TV series, obviously. And it's, I actually think it's kind of rare to see her in movies, but then I'm not very familiar with like really old Hong Kong movies as well. So I might be mistaken on that.
Well, she, I mean, she was a bona fide film star, but you're absolutely right. I mean, in modern day, she's a sort of a beloved, same way we might consider, she's a national treasure, same way we might consider something like someone like Stephen Fry in the UK, you know, somebody who's part of the furniture. He's on TV every day. I think she does chat shows, she does TVB dramas and that kind of thing, you know. And when she's ill, the whole country worries about her, that kind of thing.
Well, but I think it's important for people to understand is that Hong Kong entertainment is a really big part of everybody's lives. And I remember when big stars, you know, all the big stars that in Hong Kong that got affected, you know, Anita Mui and Leslie Cheung and their deaths. And even like, you know, I don't know if she's very popular, but anyway, I forgot her name. I forgot her English name, at least. And just these people, when they pass away, the country, like the city mourns over them. You know, it's a big deal. I mean, it's, you know, it's such a key factor, you know, like it doesn't really reach a lot of people, but like outside of Hong Kong. But I think that, you know, Hong Kong cinema really has a nice foundation where it is.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, especially 90s films.
Cool. And just also getting into the various dishes that we see here. I mean, this is, the whole competition is kind of like a Iron Chef situation, which really amused me actually talking about Iron Chef is because obviously Iron Chef's headed up by Mark Dacos, who to people like myself is known for like his appearances in like Drive, and he played the role of Axe Draven in the Crow TV series, and yet there's a whole other group of people who just know him as Iron Chef and not as an actual martial artist, so that amuses me greatly. But the dishes that we have here, I mean, are these real dishes or is this just weird things out of Stephen Chow's imagination?
Well, I think they're certainly based on real dishes, aren't they?
Oh no, they are actual real dishes. They're highly, like, especially like that Buddhist wall thing. I forgot what they call it because I didn't watch it with the English translation. That is actual like fancy dish. You know, like it's you pay good money to eat that because it takes a long time to make.
Is that the one with all the thousands of ingredients in it?
Yes, that's the one that Bol Tong makes.
Yeah, because that's actually from sort of the Buddhist history. Yeah. The idea was, you know, it's all got this meats in it, and that's the test as a true Buddhist vegetarian. Could you not eat that thing with all these delicious meats in it? So it's real, but he's putting a spin on it for the laugh.
Yes.
And also we got my personal favorite, and this is why I wondered if there was an issue with the translation here, and it's like pissing beef balls, which he combines out of beef balls, which I assume would be like the sweet and sour pork balls that we get over here, and pissing shrimp, which I've never heard of.
Yeah, I've never actually had pissing shrimp, but it is an actual thing. The thing that happens is actually very similar to what happens when they eat a pissing beef ball, is that when you bite into it, it kind of like leaks. I don't know how to say that. I've never tried it before. Maybe I will. I don't know. So it's actually very reminiscent of, like, I think it's very accurate. Pissing beef balls is a nice way of translating it. I wouldn't have done any better. It's just, you know, it also helps to make it so absurd, right? Because it gives it that, like, very visual humor to it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's basically, you know, it's Hong Kong street food, yeah? So,
yeah.
But balls of bits of odd meat on sticks, that's what they like, yeah. So usually it's fish balls, I think is what I've had out there. But it really is, the pissing shrimp is a real thing.
Yeah, and in true Stephen Chow fashion, I mean, he ends up at the Shaolin Temple. The Shaolin Temple is where he's going to find his redemption and get into, like, true warrior mode. And why the Shaolin Temple? And more to the point, why do we have a monk called Wet Dream? As you explain this one away.
Okay. So I think that it's important to know that whenever Yitat Lao is in anything, he is ridiculous. Like, in the most hilarious way and the most absurd way. And I think that is really how he fits in a lot of movies. And I don't know why he's called Wet Dream. But I think in the term, it's just a funny thing to add in.
Yeah. There's so many quirks with Stephen Chow movies, such as, like, why does these female leads that always got some physical flaw? I mean, when we look at Shaolin Soccer, the love interest in that, she's kind of plain looking to the least. And then when we obviously look at Turkey in this film, and she's got the scar down the left side of her face. Why is Stephen Chow insisting on making these less than perfect love interests for his characters?
I think he's more interested in having pretty ladies around him, to be honest with you. But maybe it's to mirror his character's own change. But you're right, yeah, Vicky Zhao in Shaolin Soccer's all scarred up, isn't she? And yeah. And suddenly she becomes beautiful again, although it's a bit like, you can't really hide something, so it's a bit silly. But it is strange. But I mean, but you know, isn't Karen Mok isn't your classic Hong Kong girl, to be fair, anyway. I mean, she's a girl of many races, that one. She's about an eighth Welsh, so we'll claim her for our own. But she's a big star. She's a big singing star, not just as an actress. So she's not a sing girl, I would say. She was a big star before that, but yeah, she's great because she doesn't seem to mind hiding behind those ridiculous teeth and the scars and the quite creepy character that she is.
Well, when they're having that staring contest at the beginning, when the two characters meet and they're arguing over the noodles.
And his sorted noodle, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so unusual the interactions his characters have at times. But I mean, you mentioned Renny. I mean, she's obviously a singer as well as an actress. I mean, when we look at Stephen Chow again, I'm not sure why it is, especially in Hong Kong cinema, that you can't be an actor, you can't be a director, you have to have all these different hats. I mean, Stephen Chow, his listed amongst his many skills is he is a director, an actor, producer, political advisor to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, and martial artist. Kim, why do Hong Kong actors have to wear so many hats? Why can't they just do one thing well?
So I'm gonna share something with you that that's been actually around for maybe over 10 years now, and actually one of the, I think he was either a songwriter, Jim Wong or something like that. I can't remember his English name. Before he died, he actually went to have his master's and a PhD or whatever. And in his art, he wrote about the entertainment business. And he wrote about the downfall of the Hong Kong industry. And it is exactly for those reasons. He was explaining how back in the days, you know, when cinema first started in Hong Kong, there was, you know, just 60s, 70s kind of thing. You really had actors who were actors, actresses who just did everything they were good at. You know, everyone focused on the things they were good at. And then, you know, halfway through the 80s and 90s, you start seeing people being influenced by commercialism and just having to be in the public eye all the time because things were changing so fast. And, you know, that was when the downfall started happening, that everybody couldn't just have one avenue of income. You needed to have multiple avenue of incomes because your value as an actor came in all the ways you can bring in the money. And that's how people ended up being singers and actors, and they needed to do all these things in order to succeed in the business because they needed to be in the public all the time, so that the idea is that the public won't forget them. But that was also what caused somewhat of a downfall of the Hong Kong industry, where, you know, the quality of things started decreasing. And, you know, I agree with a lot of that. You know, I think that, you know, some people really force into taking so many hats. I don't really see why that has to be done. But at the standpoint of the companies, I guess it keeps them competitive and it keeps their stars always making money for them.
Yeah, I mean, it fascinates me when we obviously look at some of the mainstream stars of Hong Kong cinema, especially those who have had transferred over and had Western appeal as well. The fact that we view them as being these clean-cut actor types, when we look at, like, Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, we just, you know, we assume that they're just sort of these clean-cut martial arts types and, you know, revered.
Sammo Hung more than Sammo Hung more than Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan actually partially a singer for a while. So he has a few songs and he had an album that came out and stuff like that. So he wasn't, you know, he had his focus. No, he was always the best.
He's still doing it, Kim. So this Foreigner film, I watched that the other day, and in the Chinese version, he sings the song over the closing credits. not in the Western version, but, you know, he still warbles a tune at his ripe old age of whatever he is.
He does the same in Thunderball as well, his take on Fast and Furious. He sings, whenever he sings the theme tune, I just think of that Little Britain sketch. It's like, oh, I sing the theme tune. it's just funny when we obviously when I was speaking to yourself, Kim, and we were talking about like Jackie Chan and stuff, and you're saying no, they're quite heavily involved in like scandalous lives over in Hong Kong and that. So
I remember it's a small island, right? There's a lot of people live there, but not that many, and it's a very culturally, you know, being Cantonese, it's culturally very different to the rest of Asia. So there's obviously the Western mix and stuff, but they love a scandal mag they still, you know, you can still suffer from a scandal, but I suggest maybe not as much as you would if you were a mainland Chinese actor or actress.
I have to say,
get blackballed.
We never hear about this. I mean, if you have like, if someone over like Western actor has a scandal, then everyone seems to know about it, no matter where you are in the world. If a Hong Kong actor has a scandal, we don't seem to hear about it.
I promise you, the
multiple wives and multiple families.
It's all over the interwebs, mate. There are websites I can point you at that are full of the scandal and the gossip. That's exactly how I know that no one actually likes Stephen Chow.
He's
Kim said it nicely about that. He's, you know, it's because he's very exacting, but actually it's quite a lot to do with his avarice and his love of money, and he's treated some people that were his friends, like Ng Men Tat, quite badly, which is why he wasn't in The Mermaid, and various other people. And actually, you know, when we said that, you know, Karen Mok has actually spoken out in defense of him quite a lot, there's been quite a lot recently as well. She's been one of the few people to maintain a friendship with him. So but you can find the scandal mags, and Google Chrome does a good job of translating. I guess it's just that, you know, that they're not necessarily, certainly the sort of the B-level people aren't necessarily in our consciousness, so it doesn't spread around unless it's Edison Wong in his camera.
Yeah, well, that rightfully killed him. So that was like, you know, he's gone. He's never coming back. He's never making a comeback. That guy is out forever.
Absolutely.
There was no way he was coming back from it. He ruined so many marriages and so many lives, and it was just, you know, it was just over like one dumb decision, you know?
Absolutely. So Elwood doesn't know what the heck we're talking about.
No, I'm about to say this is all completely new to me.
So there was Edison Wong was sort of one of the young up and coming
Edison Chan.
Edison Chan, sorry, my my bad. Yeah, Edson Chan. He was in quite a lot of sort of early 90s, mid 90s films.
I think late 90s. He's about Nicolas Che age.
Yeah, so he's a contemporary of Nicolas Che, and he was a bit of a, I want to say ladies man, but that adds him an air of Terry Thomas and gentleman about him. But no, he was a horrible little oik that took photos of the ladies that he slept with, and they got out, and quite a lot of quite famous people were hugely embarrassed. But luckily, as Kim rightly says, he's the one that's really suffered out of it in the end.
Cool.
But you know, that was a big scandal. That was all over the papers and the internet and the news sites, and so they have them. I imagine exactly the same thing had happened here, but something very similar would have happened.
Nice. I mean, do we have anything else to say about God of Cookery? I mean, Kim, does God of Cookery, I mean, if you attempted to recreate anything from it, because I know you obviously do your cooking and things over on your blog, and you did give me a really good recipe for pho, so thank you again for that.
I don't know. I mean, God of Cookery is good. I don't know. I don't have any fancy words for God of Cookery. I just like it the way it is. I mean, it is about food, which is a big plus on my side, you know. I mean, I think that Hong Kong should make more movies about food. That's just a personal opinion.
Absolutely. And one of the things I liked about, so talk to a little bit about the street food with the pissing beef balls, but also, you know, the final meal that he makes is a very almost plain rice and, is it roast pork, yeah, roast goose? Can't remember. I mean, the first day I went to Hong Kong, the first meal I had was a bowl of rice with roast goose and roast pork. Plain, simple, and it was one of the best meals I ever had. And again, to me, that's Hong Kong cuisine, really, in a nutshell. Sort of a very good but basic standard foods. So all that fancy stuff around it, actually, what he's grabbed is at the core, it's the basic, hearty food of the common people is what he's going for. I also love the film because it's got places which I love in Hong Kong. So it spends some time in Central with the skyscrapers, and it's all very familiar landscape to me. The Temple Street Market where the fortune tellers are, and also they don't show all the tap being sold, but they may make it a bit better. And then the competitions held in Aberdeen where the floating fish restaurants are, which is a very iconic site. So, you know, I just think this may be, of all his films, it's the most one that's almost a love letter to Hong Kong in the way that some of the others maybe could be transplanted to other places.
Nice. On to further viewing. What would you pair this with? I mean, Kim, I mean, if someone does like God of Cookery, what would you recommend they watch next?
I was actually really stumped by you asking me that, because I have, like, the most generic movie, and I think everybody's seen it, so I don't know. Like, I would pair this with Shaolin Soccer, honestly. Just for the fact that, you know, there's, like, that Shaolin element that links together, and he plays a very kind of similar kind of role. There's kind of, like, that same sort of, like, you know, not-so-pretty love interest who, you know, becomes very inspiring for him. That sort of thing. You know, there's a lot of characters that kind of blend. And I really think that, you know, I actually think Shaolin Soccer was kind of like the mirror of God of Cookery, but for the Western world and, you know, and the CGI. And I actually think I would pair those two together.
Cool. Stephen, what do you want to pair with it?
Okay, so I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do a Stephen Chow movie and another movie. So, obviously, I listed a lot of Stephen Chow movies, and Shaolin Soccer actually is one of my favourites as well. And my brain's just gone. I've forgotten what I was going to pair it with. So I'm going to go back. So if you get God of Cookery, and you can see beyond all the stuff which is hard for us to understand in the West, my absolute favourite of his is Love and Delivery, which is really molded. It's really weird, but there's a lovely narrative to it. There's if you could handle a strange character with a Garfield mask on coming at you and people doing judo, and lots of it doesn't make any sense, but it is the classic Stephen Chow movie in the sense that he starts from nothing, can then become something, and it's just got a lovely cast. And I just think it's really entertaining, but I do think it's sort of a second level movie. You need to have understood something like Shaolin Soccer or God of Cookery first. The other film I would recommend is, I suggested that Stephen Chow didn't invent this style of cinema, and he's not the only practitioner of it. He's just the most famous. And I'm hoping Kim knows who I'm going to talk about, Carol Dodo Cheng.
Yes.
She predates him a little, but her Fatal Ways films, I think, are excellent, especially the first one. In a very similar vein in terms of the comedy, she's brilliant. She's, to my mind, I think she's probably the finest Hong Kong female comedian on film. Everyone can disagree if they want. And her Fatal Ways is especially excellent because it's dealing with the pre-handover crisis that Hong Kongers will be having of what's going to happen when the mainland Chinese take over in 97. But it's a really entertaining film with that backdrop on it. And it just shows you that Stephen Chow isn't the only funny person in Hong Kong.
Cool. For myself, I'm not going to choose a Stephen Chow movie. I'm instead going to go for the Sammo Hung directed Meals on Wheels, the Jackie Chan film from 1984. Again, stars Jackie Chan and Yuen Bro. And this is probably one of the first Jackie Chan movies I saw, and obviously ties in to the theme of food here, because it sees Jackie Chan running a fast food van in Barcelona. And I mean, this film is just so fun. I mean, it's at the height of Jackie Chan's powers. So I mean, he's here doing films like this and Project A, and there's just so much inventiveness in this film. And this is obviously not even taking into account that we have like one of the standout martial arts scenes of all time, which is obviously Jackie Chan fighting Benny the Jet, the famous kickboxer. And it's just such a great and fun little film from Golden Harvest. And I just think if you always talk about Jackie Chan, most people tend to just seem to focus for some reason nowadays on what every brought out in the West, or films like Rush Hour, and see that as being the standard. And I always say, no, you've got to go back and like look at his films he was doing through Golden Harvest, or things like Meals on Wheels and the aforementioned Project A, Police Story especially. And I think this in particular is just, it reminds you why Jackie Chan's as revered and popular as he is, especially as he now, I don't know what's going on with Jackie Chan's career, to be honest. I don't know if he's getting better or he's sort of plateaued at this point. I've yet to see The Foreigner, so Stephen, I mean, is The Foreigner any good?
It's all right.
Okay. I know it's on Netflix.
All right. No. It's absolutely fine. If you want to watch a pretty good, well-directed action movie starring a septuagenarian. No, that's unfair. Jackie Chan's actually really good in it, and he's playing against type. I just think the film is has missed a beat because the bad guys are basically the IRA, but in the modern day. And so I just think it's not relevant. It's picked the wrong bad guys, and then everyone starts looking like a comedy Irishman, which takes me out of it a bit. But Chan himself is pretty good actually playing against type, and he can still, it's a couple of scenes where he does his own stunts where you think he's still got it.
Yeah. I mean, the book itself is based on the book The Chinaman by Stephen Lever, and it's pretty much just a rip-off of Rambo First Blood. And it's interesting, obviously, the fact that they cast Jackie Chan in it, because in the book, it's a Vietnamese, it's Viet Cong.
Yeah, he is in the film. He is in the film as well. He's got a Vietnamese name and everything. It's like
Vietnamese. He's obviously he's a Chinese actor. Yeah,
that took me out of it a bit as well. I didn't realise that was the case in the novel.
I thought seeing the trailer and stuff, he's there. He's playing playing, you know, a Chinese actor. He's obviously going to be the Chinaman of the thing. I mean, the reason he's in the books called Chinaman is just basic Western racism, the fact that we're supposedly not able to distinguish between the Vietnamese and Chinese people, but...
He runs a Chinese restaurant. The backstory remains the same, but he's clearly Chinese.
Dear God. Okay. And on that note, we're going to obviously move on to our pick for next week. Well, our next episode, sorry. For our next episode, we are going to be looking at more Sammo Chung. Get the words out. You can tell it's late. We're going to be looking at more Sammo Hung, as we're going to be looking at one of the more forgotten and sadly so titles of his back catalogue. We're going to be looking at Pedicab Driver from 1989. This is going to be one which is going to be interesting to obviously see if anyone is able to track it down, because I mean it's long out of print on both VHS and Laserdisc, and you can get it on DVD through the Warner Archive, so it's going to require some crate digging if you're going to watch along with us, or you know, some creative searching on the internet, I guess. But if you have, in the meantime, if you have obviously had written any reviews on Got a Cookery, or you've done a podcast on the film, please share your links with us, and we will post them up on our website. Also, if you've not done already, please hit that subscribe button or like us if you're listening to us on iTunes or Podomatic, or if you're listening to us on the That Moment In podcast network. Please leave us a review, leave us some comments, and we'd obviously love to hear from you. And especially if you've, as I said, share those review links. It's something we'd like to do going forward in 2018. It's to set up a more of a community hub for the show, and just like share links and opinions. Because I mean, the Asian cinema community, I mean, it's got this reputation for being kind of elitist, and you know, we'd just like to bring it more together, make it more of a community in 2018. So definitely, if you've done any links or podcasts you want to share with us, then please do. If you can send them through the website, you can email us at acfilmclub@yahoo.com. You also have the Twitter, which is acfilmclub, or you can leave us a message them through on Facebook as well, which is just under the Asian Cinema Film Club. Let's say thank you again to my co-host as always, Stephen.
It's a pleasure as always.
And if people are wanting to check you out, I mean, you obviously have your reviews going up on your Twitter feed, which is at LPVO.
Yep, so at LPVO is where I'm doing all my reviews of the year, but in 240 characters or less, because now I can do 240, I think I can do it justice. I'm still doing stuff at guelorambling.wordpress.com. And I might get around to doing some more stuff at easternkicks.com, but I've been a bit of a naughty boy there, and I need to, in 2018, get on top of some of my reviews and interviews and commitments. But yes, I'm all over the internet.
Cool. And thank you as well to our special guest host tonight, Kim Lowe. I mean, Kim, what's coming up on the slate for yourself? Anything exciting?
Well, like I said before, I mean, I'm trying to get the Hong Kong cinema thing into the blog and reviving my baking through Disney, which I've tried reviving two times. So hopefully third time's the charm. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, movies, books, that's it.
Awesome. And obviously if people want to find you, do you have best links at all for that?
Yeah, so Tranquil Dreams blog is klling.wordpress.com. I mean, there's, you know, you can always find me on Twitter at tranquildreams_. Okay, and then that's about it.
Cool. Well, thank you again for coming on and obviously talking about Stephen Chow and, you know, correcting some names for us this evening.
Yeah, I think I just put everything off track, so I'm really glad to be here though.
Absolute pleasure. And you corrected me, and we had a good gossip about Hong Kong Scandal, so that was brilliant.
Well, hopefully we'll get you back on to talk about more Hong Kong cinema in the year ahead. So
absolutely
cool. Again, thank you everyone for listening, and if you haven't done already, as we said already, please do hit those subscribe buttons, leave us some comments. It all helps expand the reach of the show and helps us bring more shows. But as I said, this wraps up tonight's episode, and next time we'll be back with Pedicab Driver. But until next time, thank you for listening. Hey! 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 Kinono no koi wa wasurete Odori tsuzukete itai Yoru nano sa Tsuki ga kudake chittemo Hoshi ga moete ochitemo Odori tsuzukete itai Yoru nano sa Mune ni sasatta koi no yaiba ga Moeru omoi wo Kinono koi wa wasurete Kinono ano ko wa wasurete Odori tsuzukete itai Yoru nano sa